Welcome Peter Hernes back for a second lecture. Peter is a professor at UC Davis, and today he's going to be talking about, are human values compatible with environmental sustainability? So can we do it, right?
Yes, sure we can. Monday was kind of, it's kind of a gloom and doom thing, climate change, and so that's not normally what I do. I don't work with climate change per se. It's just something that I feel like, as a scientist in a country that's sort of turning anti-science, that I need to speak out about something that I think that's pretty important. So today is a little bit more of a step back from that to, I guess, more generalized environmental sustainability. It's not about climate change per se. But before that, I just want to tell you what I really do. And what my true passion is, and personally I would love to be able to stay in my little bubble and work on the kind of science topics that I'm really, really interested in. But again, I feel like I have to move out of my comfort zone. If I have a calling, I think that that's what part of my calling is that I have to go outside of my comfort zone just to be able to try to talk to people about some of the big issues that we're facing in the environmental world right now. And obviously, climate change is the biggest one of those. But in my real world, I'm more like a garbologist. And so if you look at the garbage can, the weekly garbage that comes out of a household, you can learn a lot about how that household functions. You learn what kind of products they use. You learn a lot about what the meals are that they eat. In fact, if you start working from the top and work your way down, or you work from the bottom and work your way up, you could probably reconstruct every meal that household has gone through and what they ate. So the garbage can is basically a little snapshot about how that whole household functions. And so this is kind of what I do, except that I do them in rivers. And so I look at the garbage coming off of a landscape that goes into a river, and I try to reconstruct what's happening up on the landscape. And so, for an example, at a household garbage, this would be like going up into Copper Basin there, where you've got the water that's coming fresh off the landscape there. You can see that close connectivity between the water and the vegetation around it, the rocks that are right around it. So it's not that hard to make that one-to-one connection between what you see in the water and where it came from, what part of the landscape it came from. So that's kind of the household scale for doing river biogeochemistry. If you go to the apartment scale, then you've got a different kind of issues to work with here. This is the scale that you might sort of answer questions about, what's the recycling rate of a larger group of people. You know, at a household scale, if you pick any one household, you don't know how representative is of the entire human population. But if you go to an apartment scale, you're getting more averaging in of what's happening. And so you could answer questions about the recycling rate. You could answer questions about, you know, what is the consumption of pizza per capita amongst a larger population here. If you're an NCIS or a CSI agent, this is where you look for the dead bodies. This is where all the crime scenes start here. They don't start in your garbage can at a house. They start at sort of the dumpster level. That's what you get. So this would be a higher order river. This might be more akin to what you'd find at the base of a railroad creek here as it's flowing into Lake Chelan. Now you've got several different watersheds that are all flowing into that thing. So that one-to-one connectivity is not there anymore. So you can't answer necessarily questions about exactly, you know, I'm measuring an organic compound from here and it came from here. Up in Copper Basin, you could maybe do that, but at the base of Railroad Creek, you don't know whether it comes from Copper Creek, you don't know whether it comes from up at Crown Point Falls, you don't know if it's coming from the Holden Creek Valley, you don't know. But you're answering different kinds of questions at the dumpster scale or at the Railroad Creek scale in terms of what you're looking for. And then if you go to the landscape scale, or, you know, to the large scale, you know, to landfill scale here for garbage, this is where you start to answer questions about mattress fluxes. But you've got all sorts of other things that are happening in these landfills too. So now you've got stuff that's like 1 week old mixed with stuff that's 10 years old, mixed with stuff that's 20 years old, and you've got rain that's coming on these things, and you've got composting that's happening, and you've got greenhouse gases that are coming out of these things. So it's a very different type of information that you would get if you were going to go into this landfill and try to make conclusions about how humans live and what humans do and human processes. So this would be more akin to if you went to the Mississippi River or the Amazon River or the Congo River there. You can't necessarily answer questions about recycling rates here, and you know, you wouldn't see pretty CSI stars rummaging around in a landfill like this looking for dead bodies. That all still happens at the dumpster because they can keep their feet dry. So that's basically what I do. I look at rivers in the same way. All the molecular compounds that are in a river, they're like the garbage can for the landscape. And so I use the river chemistry to try to determine how the landscape functions. And so what I'm looking at are how efficiently carbon and nutrients are recycled and retained. We have this sort of worldwide phenomenon right now of nutrient or nitrogen pollution that's happening on the landscape. Every time you turn on, do any kind of fossil fuel combustion, you're converting some of the nitrogen in the atmosphere into nitrate. And then that nitrate goes up and it eventually rains out over the landscape. And so you end up fertilizing landscapes that previously didn't have that extra source of fertilizer. And so it's fundamentally changed the way these landscapes function because you're putting all this extra nitrate on them that they never had before. And so you see ecosystem changes on them. You see higher exports of nitrogen coming out of these watersheds. We look for different rates and types of weathering reactions, and so minerals, when they weather, have a very distinct chemistry to how they do that, and so we can look at the chemistry of the river to look at that. We can look at what happens under natural and unnatural disturbance. For example, in a nice forest, in a forest that's pristine, you get kind of a nice, smooth, dissolved organic carbon concentration in that landscape over time if you were to hook up a sensor and get a time series. But when you do any kind of disturbance at all to that landscape, then it starts to swing much more wildly. We've broken up the soil structure. It just doesn't retain that in those nutrients, that carbon, as well as it did before you disturbed it. So you see this big flush, these pulse flushes of carbon that comes out of these landscapes when you've got a lot of disturbance. And so, of course, then you throw into agriculture, and you've got a lot of agriculture. I work on an agricultural system that's fairly close to Davis, and so we've got several papers where we've tried to look at the comparisons between pristine systems and disturbed systems. Rivers respond very, very rapidly to change within the landscape. If you change something, the forest fire here that happened here, Railroad Creek, the chemistry of Railroad Creek changed instantly. And so, it works as an integrator for everything that's happening up above. And so, you don't necessarily have to go all around and sample your entire landscape to get information about what's happening. You can just sit there at the river, at the mouth, and collect samples from there. And that will give you a lot of information about what's happening up in the watershed. So we look for natural and unnatural disturbances. We look for what happens across seasons and year to year and decade to decade. And so if you change anything up in a landscape, it will respond very quickly in the river. And so that's basically what I do. And of course, part of the issue here is that in order to be able to use that chemistry of the river and relate it back into the landscape here, we need to have a Rosetta Stone to be able to interpret what it is that we have. So on the left is, of course, the Rosetta Stone. On the right is the specific molecule that I study the most. It's called lignin. And if you higher plants, one of the evolutionary changes that allowed higher plants to go up was the evolution of lignin. So you have cellulose, which is like the beams that allow it to have structure, and lignin is the glue that holds that all together. And so, but lignin also has a lot of very interesting characteristics to it, information that we use. And so that's, in a nutshell, that's what I really do, and that's what I would like to focus on. But again, I feel called to try to talk more about some of these environmental crises, environmental issues that we have to deal with these days. That's just another example about what I do. I mean, I work at the precipitation level all the way down to the stream level, just trying to sample it different ways, trying to understand how chemical compounds change and the evolution of chemistry as you go down that flow path from the precipitation all the way down into the streams. So I'm happy to talk about any of that if you'd like to ask questions or talk to me about that after, anytime I'm wandering around the village. But I just wanted to give you a little bit more of a background about what it is that I really do. And I also coached soccer for 10 years while my son was going through. So I have a lot of soccer stories if you're interested in those. So transitioning to more to this topic about environmental sustainability, there's a lot of different issues that come up in that context, and we could spend a lot of time talking about any one of them if we wanted. But I'm kind of curious to, I want to make this more discussion here and not quite so much me talking at you for this particular lecture. And so one of the things that I like to do is just see where you are on the topic of some of these crises that are impacting our nation, things, environmental issues that we need, that we should worry about or could worry about. So there's a Gallup poll that's conducted every spring, and basically they call up folks and they read them a list of these different things and say, how worried are you about this topic? And then they answer, very worried, don't care at all, what's climate change? Things like that. And so I'm going to hand this out to you in groups, and I'd like you to work in groups of three or four, something like that. And I'd like you just to rank them in the order that you think they are the most... just, you know, some kind of a consensus here, too. So, you know, just I'll start handing them out, and you can kind of... What's that? If you want to add to it, it's just it won't show up on the Gallup poll. That's all. But you can talk about some other things.
Do you have pencils for us?
Do I have pencils? You can't remember which one is, you can't remember. Mostly I'm just interested in your top three. You guys.
Our top three that we're most worried about?
Yeah, well just, yeah, the top three that you think are the most concerning to deal with. Top three. I mean, if you want to rank them all, you can, but just the top three is fine for now. I'm not going to go much further than that. No, I know that's it. Well, I'm putting the ones that Gallup asks, and so that's a very interesting topic. I'm putting up the ones that Gallup specifically asks, not what I think are the top ones. Okay, so just... curiosity, I want to see what you're thinking. So let's just start over here. Why don't you give me your top three, and I'm going to just keep track of them up here as best I can without messing things up.
We have three ones.
Okay.
All
right.
We put together maintenance of nations, fresh water supply, and pollution of drinking water is one and the same.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one was the greenhouse effect.
Okay. And then, if I'm doing the math right, you're the last group.
We had number one as the greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the extinction of plant and animal species. And number three, we also said maintenance of the world's fresh water supply.
Okay. So, what are some of the reasons for your choices? Obviously, there's a lot of folks here who are savvy about climate change, and where do you get your information from? Where does your knowledge of that come from? How does this get on your radar? Yeah.
We skipped the ozone layer because of you.
Because I told you it was fixed?
What you said the other day, that it's getting better.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, and I guess you'll see, that one acts well. I don't want to tell you what the results are here, and I just want to have some discussion first a little bit more. What about some other rationale for the climate change? Yeah.
Well, we actually thought that maintenance of water supply, pollution of rivers, and were sort of in the same as drinking water, too, so we got those more or less.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some argument to that too. There is some redundancy that goes on in this for sure. Ross?
I was just going to say for me personally, the reason that I was thinking greenhouse effect as number one is just because that seems to have a more global scale and affects everyone, not necessarily equal, but more equal footing than some of these other issues.
Right. So triage, you're thinking about it from a triage perspective.
Yeah.
There, that you have to deal with the most critical things first before you can get onto some of these other ones.
Well, and climate change affects some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
It affects the extinction of plant
Yeah, it for sure, it does.
The ocean acidification, which somebody else added in, and I would have thought of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that is an interesting thing, too, and like, if it was me, if I had a chance to rewrite history and talk about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, I probably would have started with ocean acidification and not climate change. Because ocean acidification is easy. Anybody who's had a soda knows what carbonated beverage is like and knows what that feels like on your tongue to feel that bite, that acidity. And so thinking about carbon dioxide being absorbed by our world's oceans and turning it into a carbonated beverage, I mean, I think it's a lot simpler. It's a lot more intuitive what the potential ramifications are of overloading the ocean with carbon dioxide. And I think if folks had started there and gotten, because it's a global catastrophe all on its own, aside from climate change. And I think that would have been a much, much easier sell of, you know, thinking back and trying to think about how you would market this if you want to think about it from that perspective. That's where I would have started, just because I think it's a lot more obtainable for people to understand the concept of ocean acidification. But of course, after you go to climate change first, then you get all the denial, and then you try to convince them of ocean acidification. Now you've got too much sort of built-in resistance to the concept. Loss of tropical rainforests. Let's talk about that one a little bit. Why is that one on your radar? Yeah.
One of the things that affected us was the recent news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the news there. And then about the water and the lakes and so forth, what Trump did just 2 weeks ago, as far as on the regulations.
I'm trying not to listen to what Trump is doing, but.
Just what did Trump do 2 weeks ago?
He dramatically changed some environmental regulations on what you can dump in rivers and things like that.
Wow. Yeah. And so air pollution didn't make it onto your radar at all here? Was there any discussion about air pollution? What's that?
We are not Chinese.
Yes, I know, we are not there.
It seems like the U.S. has done a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid.
Yeah, it's...
A lot of what really affects us.
It is hard, too, because... And I think that's partly the danger that happens with, I mean, in some ways we have it too good with our air and our water, and they used to be really, really bad in their own right. And through the regulation and through, trying to enforcing those regulations, and we've cleaned things up dramatically. And I think that folks have sort of forgotten what it can be, what it used to be, and now they were thinking we can back off, that we don't have to have pedal to the metal on trying to control these issues here. And I mean, you know, we're doomed to go through the pendulum cycle, I think, on some of these things without that sort of memory of what it used to be like.
This is considering particulates versus CO2 and methane, right?
Yeah, that one is, yeah, that's more smog would be the big one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Advocacy, they're predictive. They're looking at these models and they say, if this continues,
right,
then they have scary charts. that probably it is the greenhouse effect global warming that most acutely changes rapidly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's jump here a little bit and let's see how am I going to do this from current slide. So this is kind of the history of the pole running backward. And pollution of drinking water has always been the top concern, even as lately as a couple years ago. And then number two has been consistently pollution of rivers, lakes, and reservoirs. Number three, contamination of soil, water by toxic waste. So the top three things on this list are all revolving in some way around water. Why is that? Why do you think that folks have those things on their mind more so than any of these others, the other issues?
Is this confined to the United States?
It's a U.S. poll. It's a United States poll.
Because we need water. It's a basic need.
It's a basic need. It's, I mean, you're drinking something with water in it right now. I mean, that would probably concern you greatly if you knew that there was a risk to... So it's just something that we're intimately, it's connected to us personally. We all know personally what it would be like or what it's like to have concerns about water. How many of you drink, I'm just curious, how many of you drink bottled water?
I mean, it's a primary source?
That's a primary source. Yeah. I'm just, you know, that's a whole other session, the issue of bottled water and how it relates to tap water. But, I mean, I'm not going to pick. I mean, unless you want to tell me why it is that you drink bottled water, that's fine too. But I mean, if it's very common for people to drink bottled water because they're concerned about their health, the contamination potential for tap water, for their drinking water sources, things like that. I mean, that is a very common thing. And so, it's personal. And so, you know, you have a personal stake in it. Of course, you're going to worry about it because we drink and use water every single day. Yeah. There are no regulations on what goes into bottled water. It's subject to the Food and Drug Administration, but only if it crosses state lines and there's like one person in the entire country who's in charge of it. So the only regulations on... Right. So the only regulation on bottled water is if there is lawsuits against the company because of something that was in there, you know, some sort of a health threat that happens to it. So you're right. I mean, municipal water supplies, like if you've got a population center of 1 million, it's checked multiple times a day, a dozen times a day that water is tested to make sure that it's safe. It sort of varies depending on how many people you're serving, but yeah, there's just so much more regulation and testing and reporting that happens with tap water than happens with bottled water. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how many people drive there to fill up their 5 gallon car boats.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Just amazing.
Yeah, we had a spring.
It's in north of Edmonds, Washington State.
Uh huh. Yeah, we had a spring at where we grew up too, and there was just flowing out of a pipe in the park, and we would go there and drink straight out of that pipe and didn't think twice about it. It was, and at some point they regulated that and shut it down. I think the EPA or somebody did because. Yeah.
But don't you think one of the differences is that municipal water is at some government level regulated, and the government is doing it, and not you got on your own. It's just, there's this mistrust of the government that goes to drinking water.
Yeah, and it's well, I mean, I guess we know where that comes from in large part, but I mean. You know, when you think about all of the major accomplishments that have happened through the Clean Water Act and through the Clean Air Act and through, the Endangered Species Act and many Superfund and so many of the other, I mean, they've had huge benefits. And it is sort of strange, that dichotomy about how you can mistrust the government but love so much of the things that it does. But so anyway, just looking at this poll here a little bit more, I mean, at some point you could see Gallup decided that they weren't interested anymore in the contamination of soil and water by toxic waste, probably because of redundancy, and they dropped the maintenance of the nation's supply out of the poll. They dropped out damage to the Earth's ozone layer back in 2008, 2009, because it was basically a resolved situation. Acid rain dropped out at the same time because we've basically figured out acid rain and solved that over time. So it is fluid. So you would think that maybe they would wise up a little bit and add in ocean acidification at some point. But things like loss of tropical rainforest, 33% it's toward the bottom there. Why do you think that folks here in the U.S. don't care about tropical rainforest very much? Yes, it's out of sight, out of mind. I mean, the only tropical area that we have in the U.S. is Hawaii, but people aren't thinking about that too much. So, and then, of course, greenhouse effect, global warming, it's depressingly low on these things. There was one spike where it kind of perked up a little bit here in 2007. Anybody remember what the reason for that little uptick is? Inconvenient Truth. That's when the movie came out. And so there was, I mean, and so that shows you the power of film, for example, that you really can get these messages out there if you get the right kind of outlet and you get it to people in the right way. And so right now, the right way is probably social media, but I think that folks are struggling so much to figure out how to use that, how to take advantage of that power of social media to be able to get messages out. And because it works just as well for the denial side. For every truth, there's an infinite number of lies. And so it's just makes it so hard on the internet to be able to weed through it now and figure out what's true, what's not true, how to sort through it. And it's a real challenge. So this just shows you a little bit of the trends on this, and you can see that there's some peaks and some valleys in this thing. So why do you think that there was generally more concern overall about environmental issues back in the 90s compared to now?
Was it because it wasn't partisan?
Clinton, impeachment trials. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that there was a lack of partisanship there. I mean, that, you know. Any other ideas? So it really tracks with how well everybody is doing their financial well-being. Unfortunately, environmentalism is treated as a luxury for good times. And it's not something that people are willing to invest in it's like if you're trying to just make ends meet and get from one paycheck to the next paycheck, well, who has time to worry about the environment? And so, unfortunately, this is an economic trend here. And so when the economy is bad, we just don't care as much about environmental issues there. So there's those kind of cycles that are happening in these as well. An uptick around here, you know, in 2014 or so, I mean, the economy was picking up and things were looking pretty good around that time. And so so there's that sort of attitude. Other than that, I don't really have a lot of more points to make about this other than the fact that we treat these crises as luxuries. And I mean, obviously, that's not a very good model for fixing problems if we only treat them, work on them when times are good. So I want to go do one more thing here on before we get into the main topic. So this is an awful lot of prelude to getting to the issue of environmental sustainability and human values. So flip your sheet over here. This is the top 15 impairments of water in the U.S., water bodies. And so I'm interested to see what your perspectives are on what our number one, our top three problems are in terms of water quality. So every state in the country is required to go out and test all their surface water bodies and compile a list every 2 years of the impairments. And so this is the top 15. So I guess some of these things, let's see, turbidity, that's basically sediment or cloudiness of the water. Polychlorinated biphenyls, that's an aromatic compound that's got chlorine groups to it. It's very toxic. It's very long lasting. It was an industrial product that was produced at some point. So we've got mercury, and then we've got metals other than mercury. So these are things where just the biology of the system is just not healthy, but you don't really know why. Organic enrichment, oxygen depletion. So there's I don't know how much you are familiar with places like the Gulf of Mexico. There's a dead zone off the coast, right off the plume there, where you get all of these nutrients that come off of agricultural systems, and they flow into the Gulf of Mexico. They spur this massive phytoplankton bloom. All that phytoplankton drops to the bottom there, and then as it's decomposed, it uses up all the oxygen and creates a dead zone. So that's on a big scale what an O2 depletion would look like. But I mean, you can see that almost any kind of a eutrophied lake system there, where the bottom water will basically have no oxygen in it because of that decomposition of plankton. Ross? That's a different thing.
We just saw a film about a week ago called Chasing Coral, and it was about the coral bleaching and death.
Yeah, not helping. Yeah. So anyway, so that's basically the list. So work together in your groups again and see if you can come up with a top three of what you think are the most common impairments. Not the most dangerous impairments, just the most common impairments.
Is this drinking water or water?
This is just surface water. This is surface water, so it's lakes, rivers, streams. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you're going to have more acid mine drainage in the West Coast than you're going to have other places, maybe. But
nutrients,
nitrate and phosphate, but mostly nitrate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions about any of these yet, or? Which one?
We're talking about the question was that
farm
waste. I put it under nutrients.
Well, it can be both. It can be nutrients, but I guess it also can be this organic enrichment one. So I mean, it factors into both, but probably more the organic enrichment one.
And what do you mean by pathogens?
E. coli. Cryptosporidium, something like that, yeah. You have a top one or two are developing? Two? Okay. All right, I'll give it another minute. Can we make this go? Everybody's got it, two or three for your top? Well, let's start with you then and put you on the spot. Yeah, what is your top one? Okay, that's fine. Let's go with it. Okay. All right, let's see if I'm going to do this. Try to expand a little bit. Okay, and then next group back.
Temperature and pesticides. But then we have some descriptions where we weren't sure where it fit.
Okay. Pathogens, nutrients, organic enrichment, sediment, those are all pretty common in agriculture. So, I mean, you want to pick one or just move along and we'll see what happens. Okay. All right, next group. Okay. Do you have California connections by any chance?
We're from Washington.
Okay. Okay. No, mercury is a huge problem. That's another nasty topic. But in California, so in the coastal range is where all the mercury mines are. The Sierra is where all the gold mines were, and so they would take all that mercury from the coastal range. They would cart it over into the Sierra. And then basically you take the ore and you mix it up with the mercury, and the mercury pulls the gold out, and then you boil it off, the mercury. So you can imagine, I mean, of course you've got distilleries up there and you're trying to collect that mercury so you can use it, but you can imagine just, I mean, it's on the order of, 4,000 tons of mercury that was lost and released out into the environment during the gold rush days. So I guess I should get your group. You look like you're ready to go. Okay. All right, and then back group. Okay. Okay. Just two, or do you want to put a third one? All right. Okay, and then the next group. Okay. Okay, and then we got one more pair. All right, that works. Okay.
And the organic enrichment.
Okay, so a lot of folks are focused on that organic enrichment O2. Is that just because of what I described it? Is that I just sort of like planted on your brain, or are there other reasons why you picked that one in particular? Yeah.
Well, eutrophication of the degradation of lakes because of too much biological matter is one thing, but a lot of the sewage treatment plants, I mean, they have to be limited on how much of this organic enrichment that can like go out.
Well, if they have tertiary treatment, then they should be good, but I guess not all.
Well, secondary treatment actually limits it.
Yeah.
Tertiary is treating the
nutrients, yeah. But other ideas where why the organic enrichment?
There's just lots of new stories about runoff from agricultural or fertilizing their lawns.
Okay. How about the pesticides one? Why pesticides?
That's agricultural as well.
It is agricultural, yeah.
Well, actually, it's an urban problem too. I mean,
yes.
Well,
so are nutrients. They're a huge problem in from coming off of lawns.
Per acre, we're getting more pesticides off urban areas and Puget Sound than agricultural areas.
Probably because it's unregulated. Homeowners can do whatever they want and spray as much as they want, whereas out in the fields there, it's actually regulated. Well, let's just jump right to the punchline on this one here, because I want to get moving on some other things. There are your top 15 impairments. And so some of the things that I think are kind of fascinating about this is, where did my cursor go? Pesticides. Pesticides are fairly down on this list, and yet several of you had that listed fairly high on your list. And so I'm curious why pesticides made it onto your radar. Where do you think that comes from?
Bees.
What's that? Bees, the concerns about bees. This is kept up to date. States are updating their list all the time, so this is fairly current.
Okay. I'm curious because the PCBs are so high, I expect
that to be much lower. Well, they're a legacy issue. They last a long, long, long time. They have a very, very long lifespan, and so and a lot of it too is that the PCBs end up getting buried in sediments, and then rather than stirring everything up and trying to remediate it, they just sort of leave them there. So it's kind of hard to know. It's like they're not doing any damage while they're buried, and so it's kind of a tricky thing to know what to do with them. So this is done by every state has got their own EPA organization, and so the EPA is the one that is in charge of putting this stuff together. Just impairments to the surface water. This is all surface water here too. So pathogens was not on your radar, and where do the pathogens come from? Confined animal feeding operations, ranching, things like that. I mean, that's mostly where it comes from is animals. Yeah.
At one point, we had regulations on fecal coliform, which is an indicator for pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
On what can go into our surface water supplies, and then they did away with those regulations. It's one of those things I just don't.
Yeah. It could, but a lot of, they don't measure every single thing. I mean, it's actually, like you say, there's an indicator that you measure to, I mean, cryptosporidium is another one that's a big concern. So anyway, the main point that I really want to make out of this is that you look at 4 out of the top 5 here are all related to agriculture. So pathogens, agricultural nutrients, agriculture, organic enrichment, sediment, all agriculture. Yep. Are you going to ask me what causes that then? I mean, that's... So there's three different types of tests that they do when they go out and measure the waters, and one of them is specifically measuring for chemicals in there. There's another one that's called whole effluent toxicity. and you basically take the water and you incubate it with certain living organisms and see whether they die, see whether they can reproduce. It doesn't tell you what the problem is, it just tells you there's something wrong. And then there's another one that's called biological criteria, where you compare just like the whole community structure of many, many organisms within that ecosystem to a similar water body that you think is pristine, undisturbed, and you're looking and you're comparing to see whether or not the community structure between those two is the same. And it's a very, very sensitive thing, but again, you probably don't know what it is, because it's likely to be a very subtle, creeping normalcy kind of change that's causing those things too. So those would be two ways that you can get that cause unknown.
Getting back to your question, do you think there's some anti-agricultural bias or feeling amongst those of us who are
anti-agricultural?
Why? You said four of the top five were agricultural.
Well, the reason for the top five is because agriculture is so big, and you know that it's everywhere. And so this is sort of how I'm trying to lead us into this idea of environmental sustainability. 80,000 water bodies in the U.S. that are listed as impaired. Four out of the top five are coming from agriculture. So if we want to fix water quality in this country, we have to stop agriculture. So how likely is that to happen? I mean, I still want to eat. I don't know about you, but I think we all kind of want to eat. And so we've got this fundamental problem here where agriculture is the major source of water contamination, and yet we need agriculture. So how are we going to solve that problem?
So in Minnesota, the governor wants to do mandatory 50-foot buffers on every waterway, mm-hmm. every waterway in the state.
Yeah.
And the resistance to that is just phenomenal from the farmers.
I'm sure.
They're losing productivity, they have the cost of doing it. Mm-hmm. The government tell me what to do.
Yeah, no, it's tough. A question or a comment?
The question was somewhat related because mm-hmm. I was just recently at a conference in which they were discussing the role of agriculture and climate change in general and so on. And one of the things that they were focusing on was how much agricultural land, et cetera, was because of eating meat.
Yeah. Right.
So it's not quite the same as like eating.
No. I mean, there are definitely some shifts that you can do in terms of what it is that you're eating and things like that. But I mean, fundamentally, when crops are working at their most peak efficiency, they're only going to take up about 80% of the nitrogen fertilizer that you put down. The other 20% is going to end up in your water. And so there are limits to what you can do in terms of nutrient management, for example, on a field. And so you're dealing with some of those fundamental issues.
Could you repeat that?
A plant. Plants, when they're operating at maximum efficiency, will only take up about 80% of the fertilizer you put down. The other 20% is going to end up in your water. And so you're dealing with some of those fundamental issues here. And so, but again, it's like, we all want to eat. You have to have agriculture in order to support human species. And yet there's environmental degradation that goes along with it. And of course, we've talked about climate change earlier this week, probably depressingly too much about climate change here. Again, another issue about, you know, we have certain needs that we need in order to be able to function, and yet it leads to agricultural degradation. And so, you know, the big buzzword these days is talking about sustainability. We have a sustainable agriculture major at UC Davis. And in some ways, I'm a little bit cynical about that word sustainability, because every species on this planet that occupies a space impacts it. You put an ant hill into a space and it changes everything around it. You put trees onto a space, it changes everything around it. So, you know, I mean, fundamentally, it's like in order for something to live, other things must die. And so there's a real, I don't know what, I'm still working, trying to work through that in my own brain about what sustainability means, but I'm going to give you that chance to talk about that a little bit more too. So it just leads to that fundamental question about are human values compatible with environmental sustainability? And so I want to work through that question with you. I give this as an essay question to a lot of my classes there and let them wrestle with it. So we're going to approach that as if you've got an essay question that you need to answer here by the end of this class. And so how would you attack that? You've got an essay question. You're going to try to answer that. What would your approach be?
So state the question again.
Are human values compatible with environmental sustainability?
Oh, we get human values.
Yes.
Your
human values are collectively, our cultural human values, are they compatible with environmental sustainability? So you get that as an essay question, and you need to come up with a response. Where do you start, Ross? Let's do that then. So get back into your groups here, and I would like you to just come up with a listing of human values that you think are relevant to the discussion. And we'll start compiling those and see where it leads us.
Human values, U.S. values?
Whatever you think is relevant to the discussion. I mean, it's your essay question. It's your essay response. You get to answer it. So let's just go ahead and get a sampling of what you're thinking here right now up on the board, and then I'm going to let you think about it for some more. So can we just start over here and just give me sort of the top one that you've come up with so far, and we'll start listing.
Value
community. Okay, community, and the next one back. What have you got so far?
We got three or four.
Give me your top one. Clean water. Okay, next group back. Give me one.
Health.
Okay, and then next group back. What have you got? Okay, so. Okay. I'm going to put down global perspective. Okay, and then?
Big survival.
Survival. And the group behind you, what have you got?
We kind of took a different perspective. We kind of interpreted this thinking about what are the cultural values that are dominant in the Western.
That works though too, but I mean they're values,
right.
So
we said comfort, safety, stability, growth.
Comfort, safety, stability. What was the other one you put?
Growth.
Growth of what? Gonna put that one down, and then your group. What have you come up with so far?
One other. There's been a few on there that have been mentioned already. But one other one that I thought of, or that we collectively came up with, was shelter.
Shelter. Greed. I'm going to call it individualism a little bit, even though that actually is not always a negative thing there, but I'm going to sort of start with that concept of individualism, and we'll see where we go. All right, so go back in your groups here, and now you've got at least something to think about here too, and then see what else you can come up with, because this is far from exhaustive. So now we have all that space in the middle here to fill, so let's work on that. So, at this point, you're still talking about human values. Which human values? We're coming up with a list of human values, and then that's the first part of answering this question. The second,
about the good and the bad.
Everything. Put it all on the table. All right, let's just open it up and. Anybody who wants to give me some more values to fill in some blanks here, just let me know what you're thinking, and let's write some more down.
You mentioned education.
education. What's that?
Family.
Equality. Equality. Okay.
Space.
Space.
Freedom.
Respect.
Respect.
Somebody said
freedom.
Yep.
Stewardship.
Yeah, stewardship. Honestly, this whiteboard is too small for this exercise, but you know we're going to make it work anyway. Beauty. What was your one?
Virtue.
Virtue. Sure. All right, I'm just going to spill over. I was going to save this for the sustainability part, but I think I need to just do it. All right, go on. So, what was the last one?
I just said stable climate.
Stable climate. Diversity. Others?
Creativity.
Okay.
Success.
Success, yes. Yeah, that's a good one here because you can have success but not feel fulfilled. Been there, done that. What are some other ones here?
Empathy.
Empathy. Love.
Death.
Death. You want to embellish on that one a little bit more?
It's something we have to be thinking.
Yeah, you know, and so, but what goes along with death? I mean, as you're getting close to your death, what are you thinking about? I mean, not that any of us have had that experience yet, but
yes, future generations.
That's a huge one, I think.
Kind of related to that, we talked about sort of a little cluster, but not sure what to say, which would be
purpose.
Yeah,
I mean, so I run this past my classes occasionally too. It's like, what is the meaning of life? To live a meaningful life, but then you have to define what is meaningful. So I think that that's something that we're all searching for too. Is how do we each live a meaningful life? And I think that's how I guess I could put that up there. How to live a meaningful. Meaning for life. I think that's faith. Yeah, we haven't even touched on that whole concept yet. Faith, religion, mythology. Yeah.
I said this, I felt like I would push back a little bit here, but I said conformity. And I say that because, you know, diversity is up there.
Okay, so I'm going to write that like this.
Okay. But on the other hand, a lot of people...
It's the only one on the board that's different from everything else.
But a lot of people value that.
I know.
I think we all do to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What else?
That speaks to me of belonging.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well... Yeah, there's many different ways. I mean, you know, there's a lot of overlap between these different kinds of things. You can put curiosity on the board. I mean, that's why I do what I do as a scientist, is because of curiosity. I want to know how things work, for example.
Happiness.
And it, what's that?
Relationships.
Did we, is that up there already or no? Wow. It usually is by now. There's a few more. There's a few more low-hanging fruit, including one that nobody ever, ever says, no matter how many times I've done this, nobody has ever come up with this one. So there's a a challenge for you.
What mystery?
What's that?
Mystery, or does that go with faith? Religion?
Well, mystery, I mean, curiosity, faith, religion, that could all be mystery.
Reproduction.
That's... not the one that I have in mind, but it's certainly a valid one as well. It kind of goes along with, it goes along with family, wherever family ended up there. Yeah.
Survival.
What's that?
Survival, whether it's the sense of the family or the Indian tribes or the...
So, individual... but also community, tribal. I guess since you said tribal, let's put tribal. There's no reason to change that. Now, the one that never shows up, and I don't quite know why, is laughter. That we don't think of that as being a human value, but I mean, how many of us, it's it is a holding value, and no, I mean it's a value for everybody. It's just that it's not something that we think about. It's just because it's I don't know what it is. I don't know why all of these things come up here, and laughter never does. It's because clearly we value laughter. It makes our days better. It makes our life happier. We go to sitcoms. We go to rom-coms. You know, when you're wanting to meet somebody and, you know, humor, their sense of humor is such a huge part about what it is that attracts you to that person. And yet it's something that never comes up on this list of values. But I think that it's one of the most important ones, just in terms of how much it is a part of our lives.
How about peace?
Peace, yeah.
I mean, I think about the fruits of the Spirit, and we don't have a lot of them out there.
Yeah. Okay, so there are more. But now... you've got the problem that you can't talk about all 35 of these or whatever it is in your essay. You, at best, you're only going to be able to talk about two or three. So now let's try prioritizing these in your group. Can you come up with the two or three here that you think are the number that we need to, that are sort of like the most important ones on here? And as long as we're thinking about it here, I'll put up a couple more that show up frequently: power, wealth, convenience. Those are some other ones that typically make it onto this list. Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Back to conformity.
Okay.
Why did you say that's different from all the others up there?
It's, I wrote it differently. All the rest are going vertically or horizontally, and I just wrote it as a...
I thought you meant it didn't fit in.
No. I just made it vertically just as a joke.
That was your humor.
I know. Sometimes I'm subtle, but...
I brought that up because I, you know, it has a lot of negative connotations. But on the other hand, we expect a lot of conformity.
We do.
We expect people to...
The military and conformity in the military, junior high, we expect conformity and things like that.
Environmental regulation, we expect
conformity. Yeah.
So yeah. It's not always...
negative. No, I didn't mean to make any judgment calls on this thing too, here. Just just amusing myself by... All right, so I, in your group here, just have a discussion here about how you would go about ranking some of these things. What would be your top two or three? The ones that you have to have if you're going in order for you to have a meaningful and purposeful life, what would you have to have on this list? And I realize that three is a challenge and that nobody has just three, but let's see what we can do. Wow, it got quiet awfully quickly. Does that mean you've all solved it? Yeah.
Then let's decide.
Any group here ready to stick their neck out and pick three? All right. All right, so we've got our first one. So we've got health.
That would be number one. And then everything combined, the whole board.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's a good point. I mean, that's a fair point.
Our answer was relationships.
Relationships. Right. Okay. Other ideas out here about top one or two?
Community.
I mean, I recognize that you are a self-selective audience, and so that if I, you know, picked 25 people off the street, this would look like a very different exercise, but let's keep rolling with it. Yeah.
I was thinking survival.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was going to say education.
Education? I still have a job then, that's good. Yeah?
Compassion and love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, love was over here. Did we put compassion up here?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Any others that you want to talk about?
Fulfillment.
Yeah. I mean, fulfillment, I guess that really kind of lumps in with this how to live a meaningful life. It's sort of the same kind of a concept. Those would be, and relationships, obviously belonging factors into relationships. So again, there's a lot of overlap between these. So let's work with that. Let's stop with that right now. And now we need to get to the second half before we start tying these things together a little bit. What is environmental sustainability? So now you need to go back into your groups and you need to come up with a working definition of environmental sustainability so that we can tie these things together and try to answer this question. So off you go. Anybody want to throw out a definition that we can have a look at? How do you want to define that?
Using resources in a way.
Okay. That's a pretty common response, a common way to look at these. Using what you need but not jeopardizing future generations, their ability to be able to have what they need. I mean, that's one concept of it. Yeah. So I have a question for you on that. Are we just freezing it right now and preserving what we have going forward, or do we also have to look backward and restore what's already been degraded? So preservation, I'm just going to put restoration in there as well, so that we're working on both. You had something as well? Okay. Doesn't deplete, damage ecosystems. So I think maybe lump that a little bit together, yeah?
No, this wasn't discussed with the group at all, but...
Uh-oh, going rogue.
It's not even individual, but not treating the earth and the things you do as concentrating things. Whether that's concentrating all the money here, concentrating all the poison there.
I think, I mean, if you were going to put this in Naomi Klein speak, it would be something like eliminating... sacrifice zones. I mean, that would be the one aspect of that would be the negative thing, that we're not going to sacrifice certain areas for the benefit of other areas, which is what we do now. Question or just stretching?
Well, maybe it kind of relates to the idea that you're building. We kind of thought of it as a way of living that recognizes ourselves as part of a dynamic system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So humans as just one of many species would be one way of characterizing that.
So I would, taking that idea and incorporating it into the first one, I would say that we don't want to deplete them for future generations, but also for other species. And I think the damaging of ecosystems was giving
up. Is what? Right. What about timescales? What kind of a time frame? Sustainable until the sun blows up? Sustainable for the next 50 years, 100 years? Sustainable for 1 million years? Are we trying to outlive the dinosaurs? Is that what we're, you know, do we want to just live as a species 1 year longer than the dinosaurs? Yeah, for future. So how many? But in terms of planning and things like that, I mean, you know, it's really hard for us to plan for forever. We need to be able to have some kind of a time frame in which we can look at things and then check and see how we're doing and then look again. So what kind of time frames do you think are reasonable?
It could be until we learn otherwise.
I think what we need to reach is a stable
Yeah. Well, so the analogy that I brought up yesterday at the film was, you know, right now we're living off both the principal and the interest, and we're living way too much off the principal, and we need to get to a point where we're just living off the interest and we're letting the principal sit. I mean, that would be another way of trying to put it into ways that we can kind of comprehend it. I mean, you know, in Native American culture, I mean, they talk about the seventh generation and making decisions based on the seventh generation. Everything that you do now, you need to plan for that seventh generation. And so if you think about it from that concept, and you know, back then a generation maybe was like 15 years or so. So seven generations would put it out about 100 years, just having that kind of a time frame. I mean, wouldn't that be a blessing all in itself if we could have a 100-year time frame in which we made all our decisions? You know, trying to understand what the ramifications are of what we decide today would be on the year 2117. I think that if we had that perspective, I think we would get a long ways here. So anyway, it's it's your question. You get to define this however you want to, and so we have a kind of a working definition for that. So now we need to ask this question: are these human values compatible with this definition? Is community compatible with environmental sustainability? You would hope so. Yeah, it does. I mean, so there are caveats to this as well. It depends on the community. Power, is power compatible with environmental sustainability?
Well, power can be a big factor on that. I would never thought the city of Seattle would be doing composting, recyclables,
yeah,
and garbage, and they just did it.
Things like wealth. Wealth, is that a compatible value? I mean, the accumulation of wealth, is that compatible with environmental sustainability?
If it benefits all.
Well, I guess it depends on, yeah, who's accumulating the wealth and where is it accumulating. What's that? I guess, you know, we're just... What's that? Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously there's room for debate on all of these things here too, but I think... you know, if you look at the issue of love and compassion and fulfillment and education, relationships, health, I mean, health obviously depends on environmentally, an environmentally vital community or a planet here. I mean, with when the environment is degraded there, the likelihood of our health degrading goes way up. And so there is those kinds of relationships. Survival, obviously, you know, when we're thinking about the impact of climate change, there's a huge survival component to that. You know, what's going to happen? You know, I think most of us are probably insulated in many ways towards some of the effects of climate change, but there's so many people, there's hundreds of millions of people who are going to be displaced. There's going to be millions of people who are going to die from the impacts of climate change. And so, you know, there is a huge aspect of survival that needs, that, you know, that sustainability will address. Yeah.
It appears to me that just about everything on the left that is circled has to do with people and people. Whereas respect would have a lot more to do with the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Respect your actions, respect your fellow humanity.
Yeah.
And it's not, so you can do that by yourself. You wouldn't have to have.
Right. So I guess the point of this exercise for me is to, when I look at this smorgasbord of human values, it's not hard for me to start picking out a bunch of things on this list here that would give me a very fulfilling and happy life that would be very compatible with environmental sustainability. It's also easy to go through this list here and pick out a lot of things that will send it the other direction, of course, here. But I think that this is sort of I think it's clear that we need something, a different kind of a system, a different society than we have right now in order to get to that environmental sustainability. But I think, you know, looking at this list, I mean, how many of you wouldn't enjoy living in a place where relationships and community are valued and you've got healthy water and healthy food and there's a place for education and you've got compassion, fulfillment, and love, and all those things can be organized in a way that leads to environmental sustainability? I mean, to me, it's a little bit of a utopia, but I don't think it has to be a utopia in the sense that it's unattainable. I think that it is very unattainable to be able to get to that. So, of course, you know, it's easy to kind of have that vision. It's a lot harder to implement it. But I think it has to start with the vision. We have to have that vision for what a society would look like that's environmentally sustainable before we can go after it and try to put it into play. And I think that this is where it starts. In so many of these environmental issues here, there's this, you know, we have this cultural history where we have a crisis, technology bails us out, we have a crisis, technology bails us out, we have another crisis, technology bails us out. I think that we have been waiting in terms of climate change, for example, we've been waiting for that technological fix so that we don't have to do anything. But that's not going to happen. There is no technological fix that's going to make this work. It's going to take a cultural revolution. And it starts with redefining our values, redefining the values that we think are important, redefining the values that make up our society and make up our culture. That's where it has to start. And so it's not just about scientists coming up with better tools and better techniques. We already have windmills. We already have solar panels. We already have all the technology we need right now to conquer something like climate change. The only thing that's lacking right now is the willpower to do it, but we have all the technology. That's not to say that there couldn't be some more technology that would make it a little bit easier, but we have everything that we need right now. What we don't have yet is this realignment of values that will allow us to do it. And that's and so that comes in, so then it's not just about scientists, it's about economists, it's about artists, it's about writers, it's about lawyers, it's about healthcare workers, it's about everybody. And it's not just a problem that's solved by folks like me. It's a problem that has to be solved by everybody, and it starts with this realignment of values. But again, you have to have the vision first. You have to have that roadmap of where you're trying to get before you can start to figure out how to get there. And I think that that's what's been lacking in our conversation as a culture, as a planet so much, is what that looks like, what we need to do. And we're still having that big debate over what it is. And so there's many, many people who are clinging desperately to the current economic and social model and trying to come up with some way of just tweaking it to make it go. But, you know, there's this great analogy in in the Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, and I don't know if any of you have had a chance to look through the excerpts in there, but there's this sort of like fake advertising campaign that I should... I'm going to butcher it if I try to say it myself. But the gist of the advertising campaign is something like, smoke one less cigarette to have a month to have a healthier life. And that's the level at which we are trying to address climate change right now, is we've got this mentality that if we just smoke one less cigarette per month, that it will be okay, that it will all get fixed. Well, you know, you can't do that. And so we, of course, we all know that that's a ridiculous concept in terms of smoking, but we haven't sort of as a culture, as a people, come over to that realization that it's similar to that in terms of climate change and working with climate change, that we, you know, you need to quit cold turkey. You need to figure out how to get it done. You know, it's not enough just to taper off just a little bit. But again, we have to have the values in place here. You know, we have to have a life that people feel is going to be worth living, and then we can get there. So let's see what time it is here. So there's a concept that really gets to this idea here. Humans is just one of many species, and I want to spend the last time here talking about that. See if I can get this dragged over, set it up. And I'll get these boards out of the way. See if I can trip over some stuff. So there's a very common an idea in water quality that what's good for fish is good for humans. And this idea here is that if you take care of the fish, if you focus on what the fish need in their water systems, then we have great water for human beings. We're not concentrating on it from the perspective of what humans need. We just take care of what the fish need, and then we don't need to worry about it because it's already good enough for us. So deep ecology takes that another step further here, where it's not just about the fish. It's about all life. And so, this is a lot of words out here. There's basically like eight different tenets to this concept of deep ecology. And I don't know if we're going to get through all eight here, but I just sort of would like to open up the discussion here to these one by one. So let's just start with number one. Both human and non-human life has intrinsic value. The value of non-human life forms is independent of the usefulness they may have for narrow human purposes. We've commoditized everything. Ecotourism, turning ecosystems into a commodity. The concept of national parks and things like that, it's like everything has been turned in. How do we extract money out of this? How do we generate economic benefit out of this thing? And the concept of deep ecology says that there are certain things that just their existence alone is valuable, whether we can make a buck off of it or not. Yeah.
I would say that has its reflection within Christianity, as all of God's creation has value because of God created.
It would make sense. I mean, I agree with that. It's just that we've kind of lost that perspective, at least as a country, we've certainly lost that perspective. It's like, you know, everything starts with the economy. And, we have allowed the economic, we have allowed the business values to creep into our culture and take over. So there's another values in use. And so there's another concept about when you're talking about human values and how it relates to the way the world works. It's like there's values that people actually act on, and then there's other values that they don't. And which values actually drive people to make decisions and do things, and which ones are sort of passive. And so what we've allowed to happen in this country is that all these business values about monetizing everything, trying to extract monetary value out of everything has just sort of creeped into our mindset. And you think about elections, for example, like the you know, when Bill Clinton was running, it was always, it's the economy, stupid. Everything was about the economy. Economy drives everything, and we've allowed all these economic values to sort of creep in and take over. These are the ones that where all the decisions are made, is based on the economy. And so this concept of deep ecology here says, that's not right. That's not Christian. We everything has value whether we can make a buck off of it or not. And so this deep ecology concept here, it's sort of like the fish. If we can take care of everything, then we take care of ourselves. We talked a little bit about that last night too, in the concept of that if we take care of the poor, if we create conditions in which the poor can and the disadvantaged can thrive and survive and have fulfilling lives, then we create an environment in which we can all do that. So when we take care of everybody, we take care of ourselves. When we take care of all species, we take care of ourselves. When we take care of the planet, we take care of ourselves. So this is the concept. We're just one of many species, and we try to put everything on the same level. That's this first idea here between about for deep ecology. Thoughts?
Using the commodity model, it might allow us to choose the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're speaking to somebody's interest, then it is economic interest. We don't have any control of how somebody else is thinking.
Yeah.
Example being, if you could promote ecotourism,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to cutting down rainforest, appealing to the people who have the rainforest to keep it,
mm-hmm.
by getting income from ecotourism, and that would seem like that'd be the better of two evils.
Yeah, I mean, it's the better of two evils, but of course the better thing would be just to leave that place alone. Don't animals have the right to a place where humans aren't in their way and bothering them?
But those people don't have the ability to keep the big oil companies out of
it. I know. I mean, it's a multi... There's a lot of aspects of this. Of course, this is idealistic in some way, too, but it's not to say that we can't have this as a... use this sort of as another blueprint for how to shift the conversation, or, as Naomi Klein would put it, shift the story about... other comments about this idea? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where in Oregon there's all this food about, cow got killed.
Yeah.
112 bulls and millions of cows.
Mm-hmm.
So all the ranchers want to kill all the bulls. And, but on the flip side of that coin, the cows are running free. There's an incident that comes back where the semi trucks laid it right, and ran over 44 cows, just like that.
Yeah.
And nobody's saying, kill the trucks.
Yeah.
They get their money from insurance, from government, those are the bulls, those are the cows.
And of course, there's all kinds of ecological ramifications for removing the top predator.
Yeah.
And you know, so next week, I'm doing a session that's based on excerpts from the Sand County Almanac, and one of the stories that Aldo Leopold talks about is just these areas where they decided they needed to remove all the grizzly bears. They're dangerous. So they get rid of all the grizzly bears. The deer population explodes and basically destroys all vegetation on the landscape because that grizzly bear was taken out of the loop, and the checks and balances were gone. Yeah, so I mean, it's the same. That's the same kind of a concept here, where we need that balance. We need to restore that balance. But I mean, you know, do you think the grizzly bear wants to die any more than we want to die? So I mean, it's why doesn't that grizzly bear have the same right to life? Why doesn't that grizzly bear have the same right to thrive and to be healthy and happy that we do? So that's kind of the perspective that we put here in this first. Idea from deep ecology. Second one, richness and diversity of life forms contribute to the flourishing of human and non-human life on Earth. I'm not sure if there's a lot of debate that goes into that one, but I'm happy to hear debate if you would like to.
I would add to that word flourishing, that it makes mm-hmm. things more robust and sustainable.
Well, you definitely get in redundancy, and you know, you have a way of recovering from disaster and things like that if you've got that redundancy.
That could even be control.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, you know, it's the whole concept of like monocultures and agriculture. I mean, one of the problems with monocultures is that they're so susceptible to a disease that can just wipe out entire crops. I mean, we basically have maybe two banana species on that are farmed on the planet. And one of them is undergoing this massive attack from, I think it's a fungus. I'm not sure what it is that's wiping out the bananas right now, but it's like all of those banana species are vulnerable right now because there's only one, that the diversity is not there. And we've gone through many of those kinds. There was a cycle earlier where the banana trees, an earlier cultivar species of banana trees was wiped out by something similar. And so when we do all this monocropping here, we leave ourselves vulnerable. And so when you've got that diversity and richness there, you've got built-in redundancy. We're not quite so reliant, we're not quite so vulnerable to all those catastrophes that can happen when you get one of those killer diseases that pops up. Ross? Well, yeah, exotic species, that's a whole other issue there too. And yeah, that goes down another path, yeah.
And there's always the chance that the plague would solve the problem for us.
Yes, there is that. The plague is, the plague, I don't know.
The plague of diseases.
Yeah, yeah, the plagues, meaning in terms of population,
yeah, exactly.
Issues, yeah. Well, yeah, the plague wiped out 1/3 of the population on the planet. That was a pretty drastic hit. I mean, can you imagine? 2 2/3 billion people, just, yeah. Well, no, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Janet?
I was just thinking about growing up, we had clover in our lawns, so we'd go out and look for four-leaf clovers as a pastime. And I don't think I've seen any lawn recently that still has clover because we, you know, again, we want our grass to just be grass and yeah. No other thing in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. So, number three, humans have no right to reduce this richness and diversity except to satisfy vital needs. I mean, you know, this is out there, relatively speaking. It's certainly a different perspective than what we normally get. Any comments or thoughts about that one?
Depends on who gets to say what the vital needs are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, one person's vital needs, like, I need chocolate. Maybe not all the rest of you do, but I have to have that now.
Killing elephants to get ivory.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are some clear boundaries that I think you can get to. I mean, obviously, there's always going to be a gray area where people can argue over, but I think that there's a many, many cases where the line is pretty obvious. Present human interference with the non-human world is excessive, and the situation is rapidly worsening. That's another tenet of deep ecology. I don't know, is there any room for discussion on that one, or does that pretty much describe what the reality of where we live and how we live? Yeah, I mean, we do have the, yeah, clearly we have the opportunity to reverse this. I mean, so I think it's sort of a statement of the problem. I mean, and so obviously the next part is to try to undo that. The flourishing of human life and cultures is compatible with a substantial decrease in the human population. The flourishing of non-human life requires such a decrease. This one here is, you know, it generates a lot of discussion. I teach a whole class based on the book The Population Bomb, which is sort of an interesting thing. So I spend a whole quarter talking about this issue. So, I mean, we've got like just a few minutes, but anybody wants to speak about this one, happy to open it up and have discussion about it.
Well, if we don't do it consciously, it's going to happen in some other way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've noticed going to various types of meetings, political or whatever, community meetings, church meetings, no one ever wants to touch that issue.
No, it's taboo. It's very much taboo, and it's like, it just, yeah, you don't ever hear this anywhere.
We went to
Mm-hmm.
Just kidding.
Yeah, and it's
where's the stable point?
And if we would at least talk about it, I think that it would influence decisions that people make. But when it's not out there and you're not even thinking about it,
I would say we just see the real way you're creating and having a little situation, but I feel like if you're living in an environment that is sustainable life, then you don't necessarily need the human population to increase. Like in the big cities, for example, lots of roofs are turned into gardens where you have the idea of skyscraper farms that you're farming for the populations and things like that. So I think there's definitely solutions out there where we can continue to grow in the environment and continue to grow. We just have to re-examine how we're using the space that we're using.
Well, it is at least a two-pronged problem, and one of them is not just about the populations; it's about the resources that are being used. And so, it's probably both. And I'm not sure. I mean, current projections, we're at about 7.3 billion right now, and current projections right now are 13 billion by 2100. And it's kind of sad in some ways that when they put out the reports about the human population projection, and of course they have their worst case scenario, they have their best case scenario, they have their middle path scenario, everybody just kind of assumed that, well, of course we'll be on the middle path, but we're still on that worst case trajectory. Nothing has changed, and so we're still shooting up. And the best case or the middle case scenario had us kind of peaking at about 9 billion and then starting to decrease a little bit, but we're nowhere near that at this point.
Global
population, yes, global, yeah. And so, but it's an issue, and it's like I'm not judge and jury. Octomom, yeah, I'll judge the Octomom a little bit on what's happening with that. But for the most part here, it's just the discussion just needs to be there, and it's not. And then we need to have that discussion and figure out how we want to deal with it. And that's kind of where I am on that particular topic. Otherwise, it will be left, as you say, to things like a pandemic or a nuclear war or we run out of resources and massive... there are a lot of gruesome ways that the population can resolve itself, and so I think it would be much, much better for us to have this conversation and figure out how to make it go without the disaster.
Famine,
yeah, yeah.
Of course, in the late 50s, early 60s, this was really on the radar screen, as far as population.
Yep.
What's your thoughts on some of the reasons it's kind of not been discussed much?
Because it's in direct conflict with capitalism that requires perpetual growth. You cannot grow an economy without more people to consume. And so, and especially in the 80s, if there was any chance of it happening, it would have been in the 70s or whatever. But then, but you saw Jimmy Carter, we all need to sacrifice a little bit, and massive rebellion to that, and we went the other way. And so I think from that point, I think it's taboo because it messes with economic growth. It's taboo because it messes with the concept of individual and individual liberties and the rights of choice and the right to do what you want to do. I mean, so there's a lot of reasons why, and of course the Catholic Church has birth control. Stance, for example. I don't know.
Is it also because it hasn't been an issue in some of the more industrialized countries versus other parts of the world?
There's a little bit of that, I suppose. The most developed countries are at a fairly stable in terms of the birth rate. So Russia is actually decreasing right now. They're below two children per couple. So they're below replacement rate. I think the U.S. is slightly above replacement rate, but of course a lot of, a lot of population, that growth that's happening in the U.S. is happening from immigration, which is why that's a hot topic. But I mean, the whole idea of taking in immigrants and refugees around the world is a hot topic these days, especially in Europe. I don't know. So I think there's a lot of religious reasons, economic reasons why it hasn't been part of the conversation.
Culturally, in some countries, it's on a whole other world. India, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And parts of Israel.
Yeah. But like the country of Singapore, for example. I mean, and so there are.
Singapore.
They consciously worked on it. They changed the culture. And they didn't do a one-child policy. They just managed to, you know, from a top-down perspective, they changed the culture and managed to stop population growth. I think they're actually maybe shrinking a little bit, and actually a little bit concerned that they're shrinking instead of growing. And so now there's they're trying to attempt to reverse that a little bit and change the culture so that people have more children, and it's not working because it's so culturally ingrained in them at this point that, you know, that you only have so many children and that's what you do. And so I don't know. So I mean, there's a lot of really interesting laboratories around the world for what happens when governments and people have a discussion about population growth. But 13 billion by 2100, my goodness.
The population control, the debate almost caused the demise of the Sierra Club.
Yeah.
Some years back when there was a big division on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and so there's that aspect of it too, is that, you know, as soon as you start talking about control and planning and things like that, that raises all kinds of red flags politically in terms of it. But so let's just jump on to the last here. What time are we at? We've only got a couple minutes here left. Significant change of life conditions for the better requires changes in economic, technological, and ideological structures. I think we've talked about that plenty already.
Quick question, does that mean the elimination of poverty? What does that do with all
of that? I think that would have to be a goal. I mean, if we're going to try to treat every species as equal and all individuals as equal, I think that would have to be one of the goals. I don't know how you...
So the ideological structures you're referring to?
Well, that would be, I mean, policy, politics. I mean, there's the economic structure, but then there's the politics, the social network, the social net, all those things. I think that those are kind of ideological structures. You know, does the government have a responsibility to take care of people and make this go through, or are we relying on non-governmental organizations? Are we relying on charities? Who's actually doing this? I think that will all factor into it. The ideological change is mainly that of appreciating life quality rather than adhering to a high standard of living. I mean, we've hit on that theme here too. It's like at the end of the day, I think most people just want a quality life. Unfortunately, we've allowed business and our economy to define quality of life as whoever's got the most stuff has the highest quality of life. But there's so many psychological studies that demonstrate that that's far from the truth. Wealth does not equal happiness. Not enough money obviously can equal misery, but honestly, you know, our church goes down to Mexico and builds houses every year. And when you go down to there, it's like they have so little down there, and yet they seem so happy with their family and their community. And there just seems to be a thankfulness for life and a thankfulness for each other that's missing from our society. And so it's not at all just about the amount of stuff that you have. It's kind of a mindset and what you value. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of all of our stuff, and we have one without.
Yeah. So I think, you know, number seven is, I mean, for me personally, I would move this one up the list as a talking point here. I think that one is so critical. And then number eight, those who subscribe to the foregoing points have an obligation to participate in the attempt to implement the necessary changes. Again, thinking about that moral obligation about, you know, trying to speak out, get outside your comfort zone and try to make change. You know, and for me, I keep going back to social media, and I keep thinking that somehow I need to get more savvy with social media and figure out how to use that stuff, but it terrifies me because right now I can't even go on Facebook because I'm afraid of what I'm going to read. And so I don't know how to get over that hurdle for myself, but Anyway, so that's what I have. I mean, you know, we're at 4:45, and it's time for dinner if you want dinner, but if you want to sit around and stand and talk a little bit more, we can do that. That's fine, too. Yeah?
Speaking of Jimmy Carter, I was thinking about this last night, and eliminating sacrificial zones.
Uh-huh.
That what we really need to do is transfer a little piece of the sacrifice upon each of us.
Right.
Because even though we all rail against the machine and all that, everybody here is taking part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone burned fossil fuel to get here. Everyone drove on roads made of fossil fuel.
Can you speak up a little?
Everyone here needs to sacrifice a little bit. Instead of like destroying the tar sands or whatever to get the oil, if everyone lived their life so that you didn't need so much oil, they would have no reason to dig it up because there would be no money. And everyone here came through some means of oil-powered mechanized transport, you know, the airplane, even the roads that you drove here on. You know, they're made of oil, so. And I don't know if it's, I used to think that when I was a kid, and even up here at Holden in the 70s, thinking, oh, that wacko guy was cutting all over the teabag corners or whatever. But that's really what everyone has to do. It's not like everybody has to do everything and have nothing, but if you just like do 5% less of everything, that's 5% less of
some of that to has to do with changing the economic situation of corporations.
It is, yeah. But we all have a choice of how we get around and where we live.
True.
You know, but I live in a little house. I live near where I work, so I ride my bike every day. I do have a car, so I'm poisoning the world, too.
But it was interesting to me at the time that Toyota first came out with the Prius,
mm-hmm.
and all of the big car companies just thought that was, and now what should they do? One other thing I want to say about the population piece that is in there, and that is that we're all living longer.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting looking at the demographics of different countries. And so, you know, like for the U.S., when you look at the little five-year time slices, it's a little bit of a column with a little taper at the end. But when you look at some of these developing countries, it's a pyramid because their survival rate or their average age is quite a bit lower. Their childhood mortality is way higher.
In the science area, one of the most popular areas in science, biotechnology, and that is how to live longer.
Yeah.
That's a huge emphasis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things, it's easy to blame business for some of these, but, you know, we're the ones that respond to their advertising.
Right.
We
don't have to respond to it.
Yeah. No.
You know, to some extent, we're to blame because we're the ones that are responding to the advertising.
Yeah.
Walmart's a great example. All the small businesses are around because of Walmart.
Yeah.
They want cheap prices.
The Nest, yeah. And I think, I think the other aspect of that is that just expecting all of this to happen at the individual level it's foolish. It's not going to happen that, but we all need that kind of, we need the support. We need the infrastructure that allows us to make better choices, that allows us to do better with what we do. And we need more mass transportation so that we don't have to jump in our cars to go places. We need more support for getting solar panels where they need to be so that we can do that. We need more emphasis on electric cars so that if we are driving within 50 to 100 miles of our home or something like that, we have an alternate way of doing it. I would love to be able to bicycle to my grocery store and get groceries that way instead of jumping in the car to do it, but then you need to provide the infrastructure. There needs to be wider bicycle lanes. There needs to be somebody building those bicycles, more of those bicycles that have the big wooden baskets up in front so that you've got the space to do that. And I mean, so there's so many different ways there where you can envision about how infrastructural changes could support us in making those kinds of decisions. And so that there does have to be kind of a top-down mechanism to get those systems in place so that we can make those kinds of decisions and make it easy for us.
There's got to be elected officials willing to spend the money.
Yeah.
And that speaks to us getting involved in the system to help support.
Right. So that would be like number 8 there, then, on that list there, where we all have the obligation to try to make it happen.
I'd just like to say that an energy system based on something other than fossil fuels is what's ultimately required.
Mm-hmm.
And the faster we can support that change, the better off we'll all be.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously solar power and wind power are a big piece of that. But
here's one example in our church. We got solar panels from our church.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was because we got support from the state, which is encouraging installation of solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a rebate there. Part of it was we got a grant from a local organization that was supportive.
Yeah.
Government and philanthropic or whatever, mm-hmm. to get to our goal. It can be a combination of a variety.
Yeah. No, we clearly have a lot of work to do, but again, the technology is all there.
Right.
And you know, we need the right kind of help from up top to kind of push things along. Yeah.
I can't help but be pessimistic.
Pessimistic? I know.
So my pessimism tells me that we will have some catastrophic things happen as human inhabitants of the planet before those big changes.
I'm optimistic by nature, but I don't disagree with you. That's kind of where I am. But I think that for me personally, what drives me in a lot of what I do is I ask the question, will I regret it if I do this? Will I regret it if I don't do this? And if the answer is yes, I will regret it, that spurs me to act. Will I regret it if I stay silent and don't say anything and don't try to speak about it? Yes, I will.
What did you do when you knew?
Yeah, and we each need to get involved.
Yeah.
And say, will somebody else take care of you?
So, I mean, so that's what spurs me on. I mean, so fundamentally, I'm an optimist, but that doesn't mean that realism doesn't creep in as well. But, yeah.
Thank you.
All right,
you.
Thanks.